content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Diane Edelman for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Reader's Digest. Today's program is supported by the Durham Lions Club. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Reader's Digest, and will also bring you a bonus article from the Saturday Evening Post. Our first article from the Reader's Digest Innovation column, How AI is Saving Lives. Artificial intelligence can find new uses for existing drugs, helping to treat rare diseases, including the one that almost killed Joseph Coates, by Kate Morgan from the New York Times. A little over 2 years ago, Joseph Coates was told there was only one thing left to decide. Did he want to die at home or in the hospital? Coates, then 37 and living in Renton, Washington, was barely conscious. For months, he'd been battling a rare blood disorder called POEMS syndrome, which had left him with numb hands and feet, an enlarged heart, and failing kidneys. Every few days, doctors needed to drain liters of fluid from his abdomen. He became too sick to receive a stem cell transplant, one of the only treatments that could have put him into remission. "I gave up," Coates says. "I just thought the end was inevitable." But his girlfriend, Tara Theobald, wasn't ready to quit. She sent an email begging for help to David Fajenbaum, MD, an immunology researcher in Philadelphia, whom the couple had met a year earlier at a rare disease summit. By the next morning, Dr. Fajenbaum suggested an unconventional combination of chemotherapy, immunotherapy, and steroids, previously untested, as a treatment for Coates' disorder. Within a week, Coates was responding to the treatment. In 4 months, he was healthy enough for a stem cell transplant. Today, he's in remission. The life-saving drug regimen wasn't thought up by the doctor or any person. It had been spit out by an artificial intelligence model. In labs around the world, scientists are using AI to search among existing medicines for treatments that might work for rare diseases. Drug repurposing, as it's called, is not new, but the use of machine learning is speeding up the process and could expand the treatment possibilities for people with rare diseases and few options. Thanks to versions of the technology developed by Dr. Fajenbaum's team at the University of Pennsylvania and elsewhere, drugs are being quickly repurposed for conditions including rare and aggressive cancers, fatal inflammatory disorders, and complex neurological conditions. And often, they're working. The handful of success stories so far led researchers to ask the question, how many other cures are hiding in plain sight? There's a treasure trove of medicine that could be used for so many other diseases. We just didn't have a systematic way of looking at it, says Donald C. Lowe, Ph.D., scientific lead at Remedy for All, a group focused on drug repurposing. It's essentially almost silly not to try this, because these drugs are already approved. You can already buy them at the pharmacy. The National Institutes of Health defines rare diseases as those affecting fewer than 200,000 people in the United States. But there are thousands of rare diseases, which altogether affect tens of millions of Americans and hundreds of millions of people around the world. And yet, more than 90% of rare diseases have no approved treatments, and pharmaceutical giants don't commit many resources to try to find them. There isn't typically much money to be made developing a new drug for a small number of patients, says Christine Colvis, Ph.D., who heads drug development partnership programs at the National Center for Advancing Translational Sciences. That's what makes drug repurposing such an enticing alternative route for finding treatments for rare diseases, says Marinka Zitnik, Ph.D., an associate professor at Harvard Medical School, who studies computer science applications in medical research. Zitnik's Harvard lab has built another AI model for drug repurposing. Other laboratory discovery techniques have already put drug repurposing on the map, Lowe says. AI just puts rocket boosters on that. Finding clues in old research. Repurposing is fairly common in pharmaceuticals. Minoxidil, developed as a blood pressure medication, has been repurposed to treat hair loss. Viagra, originally developed to treat a cardiac condition, is now used as an erectile dysfunction drug. Semaglutide, a diabetes drug, has become best known for its ability to help people lose weight. The first time Dr. Faschenbaum repurposed a drug, it was in an attempt to save his own life. At 25, while in medical school, he was diagnosed with a rare subtype of a disorder called Castleman disease, which led to an immune system reaction that landed him in the intensive care unit. There is no one way to treat Castleman disease, and some people don't respond to any of the available treatments. Dr. Faschenbaum was among them. Between hospitalizations and rounds of chemo that temporarily helped, he spent weeks running tests on his blood, poring over medical literature, and trying unconventional treatments. I had this really clear realization that I didn't have $1 billion and 10 years to create some new drug from scratch, he says. The drug that saved Dr. Faschenbaum's life was a generic medication called sirolimus, typically given to kidney donation recipients to prevent rejection. The medication has kept his Castleman disease in remission for more than a decade. Dr. Faschenbaum went on to become a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, and he began seeking out other drugs with unknown uses. Existing research, he realized, was full of overlooked clues about potential links between drugs and the diseases they could treat, he says. If they're just in the published literature, shouldn't someone be looking for these all day, every day? His lab had some early successes, including finding that a novel cancer drug helped another Castleman disease patient. But the process was laborious, requiring his team to examine one drug and one disease at a time, he says. Dr. Faschenbaum decided he needed to speed up the project. In 2022, he and two colleagues established a nonprofit called Every Cure, aimed at using machine learning to compare thousands of drugs and diseases all at once. Work similar to Every Cure's is taking place at Penn State and Stanford universities, and in labs around the world, including in Japan and China. In Birmingham, Alabama, an AI model suggested a 19-year-old patient debilitated by chronic vomiting try isopropyl alcohol inhaled through the nose. Essentially, we ran a query that said, show us every proposed treatment there has ever been in the history of medicine for nausea, explains Matt Mite, Ph.D., a professor at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, who leads the institute that developed the model. The alcohol popped to the top of our list, Mite says, and it worked instantly. The model developed by Mite's institute has successfully predicted other treatments, too. Amphetamines, typically used to treat ADHD, relieved periodic paralysis in children with a rare genetic disorder. A Parkinson's drug helped patients with a neurological condition move and speak. A common blood pressure medicine called guanfacine drastically improved motor and vocal tics in a pediatric patient with Tourette syndrome. Many drugs do more than one thing, Mite says. Their additional features sometimes get characterized as side effects. If you comb through enough drugs, you eventually find the side effect you're looking for, he says, and then that becomes the main effect. In Philadelphia, Dr. Faschenbaum's platform compares the roughly 4,000 FDA-approved drugs against the world's approximately 18,500 diseases. For each disease, pharmaceuticals get a score based on the likelihood of efficacy. Once the predictions are made, a team of researchers combs through them to find promising ideas, then performs lab tests or connects with doctors willing to try the drugs on patients. Elsewhere, pharmaceutical companies are using AI to discover entirely new drugs, a pursuit that has the potential to streamline an enterprise already worth billions. But drug repurposing is not likely to prove lucrative for any one party. Many drug patents expire after 2 decades, which means there is little incentive for drug companies to seek out additional uses for them, says Aidan Hollis, Ph.D., a professor of economics at the University of Calgary with a research focus on medical commerce. Once a drug becomes one of the thousands of generics approved by the Food and Drug Administration, it typically faces stiff competition, driving down the price. If you use AI to come up with a new drug, you can make lots and lots of money off that new drug. If you use AI to find a new use for an old and expensive drug, no one makes any money off of that, says Dr. Fajenbaum. To fund the venture, EveryCure has received more than $100 million in commitments from TED's Audacious Project and the Advanced Research Projects Agency for Health, an agency within the Federal Health Department dedicated to supporting potential research breakthroughs. Dr. Fajenbaum says that EveryCure will use the money, in part, to fund clinical trials of repurposed drugs. This is one example of AI that we don't have to fear, that we can be really excited about, says Grant W. Mitchell, MD, an EveryCure co-founder and a medical school classmate of Dr. Fajenbaum. This one's going to help a lot of people. Someone had to be the first to try. Luke Chen, MD, was skeptical when Dr. Fajenbaum's model suggested he treat a patient with Castleman disease using adalimumab, a medication typically used to treat arthritis, Crohn's disease, and ulcerative colitis. I didn't think it was going to work, because it's kind of a wimpy drug, says Dr. Chen, a hematologist-oncologist and a professor at Dalhousie University and the University of British Columbia. But the patient had already undergone chemotherapy and a bone marrow transplant and had tried drugs including the one that saved Dr. Fajenbaum's life. Nothing had worked, and the patient was entering hospice. We had basically given up, but I put in a last call to David, Dr. Chen says. With no other options, Dr. Chen gave the patient the adalimumab. In a matter of weeks, the patient was in remission. The case was recently the subject of a paper in the New England Journal of Medicine. Still, no model is infallible, Zitnik says. AI can sometimes make predictions based on evidence that isn't sufficiently strong. Colvis says ranking potential treatments by likelihood of success can also prove difficult. Such issues make physician oversight crucial. Sometimes a doctor will determine that a treatment suggestion is too risky to try, she says. But then there are instances when they will see something and say, okay, this looks like it's reasonable, she adds. When Dr. Fajenbaum first suggested that Wayne Gao, MD, a hematologist and oncologist in Washington State, try a novel treatment on one of his patients, Dr. Gao had doubts. The patient was Joseph Coates, the Washington man headed for hospice, and the aggressive drug combination suggested by Dr. Fajenbaum's model seemed a little bit crazy, Dr. Gao says. In fact, he worried that the treatment might kill Coates faster. But Coates was a young man, and there were no other treatments to consider. And so, Dr. Gao says, someone had to be the first to try. Just over a year after his brush with death, Coates and his girlfriend visited Dr. Fajenbaum in Philadelphia to thank him for his help. A smiling Coates was the picture of health. He had put on muscle since the last time he had met the doctor. Coates had tweaked his ankle that morning while working out, but otherwise, he said, he felt just fine. That was How AI is Saving Lives by Kate Morgan. Our second article from the Reader's Digest Life Well Lived column, Don't Trim the Azalea. The Beauty of a Wild Unpruned Punk Rock Shrub by T. Edward Nickens from Our State. Left untouched, the azalea beside our house in Morehead City, North Carolina, would take over the entire yard, and it wouldn't stop there. Already it's 7 feet tall and fat enough to house 6 of Snow White's 7 dwarfs. If Black and Decker and I didn't keep it in check, it would engulf the yard, consume the house, annex the block, and begin to shade the entire planet, turning day into night and ending photosynthesis on a global scale. Forget climate change. Fear my azalea instead. This was my mindset last spring as I approached my vernal nemesis, pruning shears in one hand like a six-shooter, hedge trimmers in the other like a sawed-off shotgun. The azalea's purple-pink blooms lay on the ground, wilted and spent. This was our annual date with destiny. I'd made good progress on half the bush and was teetering on a stepladder, about to attack the top, when suddenly a bird flushed from the interior of the shrub and streaked off toward the backyard. It was a brown thrasher, and I'd been watching it, or its mate, in the backyard for weeks. Uh-oh, that could be a problem, I thought. I pulled a few branches apart, peering deep into the dark heart of the azalea from hell, and spotted the bird's nest. Tucked into a slightly ramshackle bowl of twigs and leaves, thrashers aren't known for their tidy habits, were 3 downy chicks. And I had a decision to make. It's a sad folly of modern life that we think we're somehow separated from the natural fabric in which we live. It's a perspective built on a calculus of artifice. Brick by brick, by technological advance, we've convinced ourselves that we live apart from the bird and the turtle and the fox. But it's a perspective that diminishes the lives of both humans and wild creatures. In a world older and more complete than ours, wrote Henry Beston in his book, The Outermost House, animals move finished and complete, gifted with extensions of the senses we have lost or never attained, living by voices we shall never hear. They are not brethren. They are not underlings. They are other nations, caught with ourselves in the net of life and time, fellow prisoners of the splendor and travail of the earth. In a lot of ways, how we live our lives is a matter of choosing how we wish to impact those other nations. A bird flushing from a side yard azalea is proof that those other nations aren't out there in some abstract fashion. They live among us and with us and alongside us. Whether it's a drive to the grocery store or an approach to lawn care, the act of everyday living has real-world impacts on our furred, feathered, scaled, and exoskeletoned fellow travelers. We either choose to ignore our impacts on those other nations, or we choose to be as neighborly as possible. I'll be honest, brown thrashers aren't the prettiest birds. Where they aren't solid brown, they're spotted with brown. They have startlingly yellow eyes that make them look like they're mad at somebody, and that somebody might be you. They're scroungers that use a stout bill to thrash through leaf litter to ferret out bugs and seeds. They are exuberant singers, I'll give them that, but even that talent is underappreciated. Like the mockingbird, their taxonomic kin, along with the gray catbird, they sing in repetitive phrases and mimic other birds, sort of an ornithological cover band. None of them would win the Wild Kingdom's version of American Idol. But we were all in our little corner of Moorhead City, trying to make a living, raise a few babies, build a home among the splendor and travail of life on Earth. The brown thrashers likely chose my azalea for the attributes I was there to prune away. The bush's wild growth was a refuge in a tidy neighborhood. Its disheveled demeanor helped them keep their family hidden from hawks and crows and other predators. From the azalea, the thrasher parents could dart out to glean a bug or berry from my butterfly garden and zip back to the nest with a treat for the babies. I'd already flushed a parent from the nest, and I knew those fragile chicks couldn't last long exposed to the elements. The longer it took me to prune, the longer the parents would stay away, and the greater the chance the nest would fail. Even if I made quick work of the azalea's haircut, removing more of the foliage than I had already had, would sink those chicks' chances even lower. So I gingerly retreated down the stepladder, gathered my clippers and trimmers, and walked away with the azalea only halfway pruned. Its lower two-thirds were sheared as neat as a Marine's new haircut, but the plant's top knot was wild and gangly and headed toward 8 feet tall. I'd given the azalea an impressive mohawk. I wondered for a moment if the sight might cause a few car wrecks on the corner. I felt sure the neighbors would talk. But on the other hand, my punk rock shrub seemed to me an expression of a certain understanding, an obligation that comes with living on the only planet we have. My azalea was not mine alone, nor was my little corner lot, nor anywhere I'll ever plant a footprint in this life. The other nations are everywhere, and more reliant on harmony and benevolence than ever before. What would the neighbors think? I hope they'd think that I was just the sort of neighbor they'd like to have. That was Don't Trim the Azalea by T. Edward Nickens. And now a bonus article from the Saturday Evening Post. GPS is my co-pilot by Cable Newhouse. As revolutions go, this one began quietly, with a buy rather than a bang. Location? Hunter's Hill, a Sydney suburb so small you'd be hard-pressed to pinpoint it on a map of Australia, unless you had the right kind of map, which, until relatively recently, you almost certainly did not. It was there, in the opening days of 2004, that four guys who ran a startup called Where2 Tech sold their company to Google, which saw an opportunity. Weeks later, the pioneering technology, rebranded as Google Maps, was introduced to the public by its new American owners. Within 24 hours, Google Maps had been viewed 10 million times. The satellite navigation revolution was officially underway. It's estimated that today, in the United States, some 230 million of us rely on GPS maps for turn-by-turn guidance to everywhere that has been photographed from a satellite, even if that where has seldom seen human visitors. The technology has transformed the way we see our planet, and more importantly, how each of us can find our way around it. No more getting hopelessly lost. Before Google Maps, I wandered the earth aimlessly, discovering villages and hamlets untouched by the 20th or 21st centuries. Toothless inhabitants would surround my car in wide-eyed wonder and ask if I fell from outer space. My friend John Oliver, a New York writer, recently posted on Substack. He was exaggerating for impact, I think. The fact of the matter is that most of us would just as soon embark on a journey without some sort of small navigation device as walk out the front door pantsless. The big guys in this space include Google Maps, of course, but also Apple Maps, Waze, and TomTom. As a navigationally challenged American, I rely on 4 sat-nav services on my phone and in my car. Each has its particular strengths. Details about dining specials along my route, or scenic paths, or just cool on-screen graphics. Some folks claim they've become emotionally attached to the voice they selected for their GPS's spoken directions. Not an issue for me, but a Californian I know told me he's addicted to Chaka Khan's soothing tones on his in-car system. Relax your mind. Turn left. We're gonna get there. I freaking love her, he said. It's no surprise that most car buyers in 2026 say they won't even consider a model unless it has a wireless sat-nav system, such as CarPlay, on board. GPS guidance is no longer merely a convenience. Today, it's central to a lifestyle that demands our total surrender to the ever-expanding embrace of microchips. Even so, there remains a subset of folks who refuse to crumple up their old paper maps. Some of those were indeed things of cartographic beauty and, in their era, trusted companions. AAA's iconic triptych finally went digital a while ago, but those spiral-bound and once-indispensable Thomas guides on the West Coast still serve a coterie of hangers-on. What's the downside of satellite navigation? Well, for one, imagine what would happen if the system suddenly collapsed, even for just a few days. The technology is responsible for billions of dollars of economic benefit to the country due to the logistical efficiencies it's enabled. Without it, the super swift deliveries we've grown accustomed to could not happen. Imagine, if you will, no Amazon. Next up, universal navigation of indoor spaces. It's a work in progress. Give it maybe 5 years, experts say. That was GPS is My Co-Pilot by Cable Newhouse. And finally, again from the Reader's Digest, life in these United States. I'm short and stout, so buying attractive clothes can be something of an adventure. But a friend of mine gave it her best shot when she bought me a gorgeous white dress as a present. I happily tried it on and modeled it for my brother. "Well, what do you think?" I asked. He gave me the once-over and answered, "You look like a gallon of milk," by Nan Bogosian from Clinton Township, Missouri. During breakfast, my friend's young daughter asked the question all parents dread. "Are you the Easter Bunny?" Looking confused, she followed up with, "I mean, how would you get into everybody's house?" By Bill Henderson from Bluffton, South Carolina. Scene: my dad offering 8-year-old me a handful of walnuts. Me: "I can't have those. I'm allergic." Dad: "What will happen?" Me: "They make my mouth itch." Dad: "That's just what walnuts do." And that's when my dad learned that he's also allergic to walnuts. By Blair Manny on Threads. We have now run out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest. Today's program is supported by the Durham Lions Club. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Diane Edelman, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Reader's Digest is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.